The subject of affairs, I think, I think it's of interest to everybody. I think we have all had an Oedipal experience. We've all been babies that have at some point realized that we are not the only person. We're not perfectly fused with our mother and that she has other things to do, and there may be a father. And so I think we've all known what rejection feels like, and probably betrayal and preferment. And I think that affairs are in our unconscious, and I think that's sort of evident really in the way that most great novels, most great films, or at least many, have an affair at their heart. From Anna Karenina to Madame Bovary to Fatal Attraction. I think this is something that is just, we're interested in affairs. And I wanted to write about affairs because I think they are a way of showing what psychoanalysis can do actually, in a field which is of, everyone has an opinion on, and probably most people in some way have been indirectly or directly affected by. And that was really the sort of the genesis for wanting to write about affairs.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Juliet Rosenfeld. Juliet Rosenfeld is a psychoanalyst and a member of the British Psychoanalytical Society. And our conversation today is around her second book, which is entitled Affairs, True Stories of Love, Lies, Hope, and Desire. And what Juliet set out to do, and I believe accomplished, is to not only add to our professional understanding of affairs, but also to write in a way that is accessible to non-clinicians, which is no small task. And we discuss both what she learned about the inner lives of the patients she spent time with, and also how she set about making it accessible to others. This interest of hers may derive from the fact that she had a 15-year career in advertising and marketing, and she ended up in government communications. During this time, she also started taking a master's at Tavistock, trained as a psychotherapist. She became an elected trustee of the UK Council for Psychotherapy and is presently one of two clinician trustees at the Freud Museum. Her first book, called The State of Disbelief, which is a memoir and an account of an experience of sudden bereavement. She and I had a conversation on a different podcast some years ago around that book, which is also about love. And this one, Affairs, True Stories of Love, Lies, Hope, and Desire, which was just recently published. There's much for us to learn both about the subject and how to make it accessible to our listeners or readers. I recommend her book, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Here's my discussion with Juliet Rosenfeld. As you know, our field faces a challenge. And the challenge is, how do we let the broader community know about our work? And there are a number of things that make that difficult. Firstly, our work is foundationally confidential. And we're going to discuss that today. It's also very complicated work. It may appear to an outside observer as simply two people having a conversation. But for those who have been in it on either side, you have a sense that it is not just a conversation. Which leads to the third obstacle or third challenge in popularizing our work is that there's something odd about it. And when I say odd, I mean that there are aspects of the relationship between a dynamic therapist and their patient that is unlike any other. It is not one that one chats with, in, or simply gives guidance, though clearly that takes place under the broad umbrella of a dynamic treatment. But it isn't limited to that. There's an asociality between the two people that allows for discovery of new ways of thinking and new ways of knowing oneself that one can only get through the creation, maintenance of, and struggle with that asociality. And has been noted on this podcast, an important consideration is to be clear that asocial is not synonymous with unfriendly. And I'm afraid our field has been tainted by those who don't know the difference between those two. And so the challenge is, how do we take our work and make it available to others so that it makes sense to them? It adds a richness to their understanding of what can happen between two people. And I must say, with this work of yours, you've provided a tutorial for us. You've taken a complex topic, certainly a lively one, and you've spoken of it in a way that both honors the complexity and also in a way that makes it accessible to the broader community. And as evidence of your success, this book has been digested in The Guardian, a well-regarded and widely read UK newspaper, and it's also been reviewed widely in the general press. So it's not only I who think you're doing something right. I think the editors and the broader population recognize that you're bringing something special to the table. We're going to return to the topic of how one spreads or shares this way of thinking with the broader community. But to begin, I'd like to spend time on the book itself. And I want to start us off by my reading two quotes. The first is literally one sentence. And it represents, in my experience, practically a universal sentiment of those who are involved in affairs. And the second, more lengthy quote is your reflections on the nature of affairs. And then I'm going to ask you to unpack these for us. The first sentence, and this is a quote from one of your patients, writes, "I felt, finally, that I had what I wanted, and as if for the first time in my life, I could be loved and love." That's quote one. Quote two, you reflect on this and you write, "Once we reach adulthood and the complexity of finding a partner, nothing is straightforward. In the search for love and sex, few of us are immune to the pain of love and loss at some point. Whether that is being rejected as a teenager or being widowed in old age, being alive and loving means we suffer. These stories in this book," you write, "are about loss, but also love. What is distinctive in these five stories, but I would argue in all affairs, is that there is, however unconscious, agency in choosing to suffer or to inflict pain in this particular way. I want to show how otherwise reliable, sensible, kind, loving, thoughtful individuals can become selfish, sexually obsessed, risk takers. Common sense vanishes, jeopardy triumphs. Two people involved in an affair often believe they are star-crossed lovers, or it was meant to be. But this is fantasy." Juliet, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks very much again, Harvey, for asking me to come on to your podcast, which I've listened to, I think, since its inception, and I find it such an interesting way of learning about what psychoanalysts are doing, you know, around the world. And so it's I feel very privileged to be here, actually. Yeah, I mean, the subject of affairs, I think, it's of interest to everybody. I think we have all had an Oedipal experience. We've all been babies that have at some point realized that we are not the only person. We're not perfectly fused with our mother and that she has other things to do and there may be a father. And so I think we've all known what rejection feels like and probably betrayal and preferment. And I think that affairs are in our unconscious. And I think that's sort of evident really in the way that most great novels, most great films, or at least many have an affair at their heart. You know, from Anna Karenina to Madame Bovary to Fatal Attraction. I think this is something that is just, we're interested in affairs. And I wanted to write about affairs because I think they are a way of showing what psychoanalysis can do actually in a field which is of, you know, everyone has an opinion on, and probably most people in some way have been indirectly or directly affected by. And that was really the sort of the genesis for wanting to write about affairs.
Now, as I mentioned, we all face the question of confidentiality, perhaps more so if there's such a thing with the subject of affairs. Tell us about, there's one person in here, or one composite person, that you actually treated, and you'll describe for the listener how you approached the other people to learn what you learned. But start us off by your story with who you call Professor M.
So Professor M, you're right, is a composite, and we are going to come on to this vexed, I think, subject of how do we write about the work for non-clinical audiences. But Professor M was someone who came to see me. She was an academic in her early 60s who had never felt sort of troubled to see a psychotherapist before she ended up in my consulting room. And she came because she wanted to talk about an affair that was underway and that she was completely consumed by, actually, and that was completely secret. And obviously, as analysts, we are often the third participant in an affair when one or both parties feel that someone outside the affair needs to know about what is going on. I mean, it's a whole other question about why and when. But so she came to see me, and she was in a relationship with someone she had met in graduate school and then had recently reconnected through a professional conference. And the problem, I suppose, for her at that point was not so much that she was also in a very long-term partnership with a man here, but was that she was passionately in love with this, with her lover. And that was what she wanted to talk about. But it was a very difficult treatment because for about 2 years, really all she would talk about was her lover and a kind of growing longing that he would leave his wife for her. So it was almost as if the sort of problem was brought to me more than the feelings or the difficulty, I should say.
As you write about it, you described being an enforced distant witness to her tales, often highly charged erotic tales, dramatic tales, but you were the bystander, suggesting perhaps that she was a bystander in a childhood situation that she was reenacting with you. But nevertheless, you were stuck and needed to honor what she needed to do with the space, which is to use you in that fashion. But in the meantime, I imagine you had a sense that this was all not going to end well. That kind of manic, even aside from what you learned about the externals, about him and how they met up and all, there's something about her being in such a chronic frenzy about this that lets one know that these things don't tend to just quiet down. They tend to collapse, which, of course, is what happened.
Yeah, that's right. And I write a bit about when I had the feeling that it wasn't going to end well, which wasn't immediate, actually. And I have thought about that and whether I was kind of co-opted into this folie à deux, one might say that she was in. But she did begin to collapse when, as it were, the fantasy that he would leave his wife was over. And as I write, that was really when the work began. That was when finally I had access really to her mind, perhaps because she at that point was in reality and rather than fantasy, accessing the reality that this man had left her.
Let me read what you wrote about that, because it's very clear and poignant. And this is in a section where you write that over the next 6 months, Professor M accepted she would never see her lover again. And then Professor M returned to the couch with her legs pulled up on her side in a fetal position, often gasping with tears for the entire 50 minutes. Often I didn't speak at all, but my role was changing. I was witnessing someone who had been horribly abandoned through no fault of her own again. As she continued to pore over the relationship, one winter morning, Professor M told me something new. Her attraction to her lover had deepened in their second summer together when he grew his hair long. She remembered long sessions in bed on one of those stolen weekends when she had fiddled and played with it, telling him what beautiful thick hair he had and how it helped him and helped to drive her wild with lust. She suddenly remembered that the only other man she had ever kissed with long hair was her late father. When she was two, about to turn three, he had left her mother, never to return, and emigrated to the other side of the world. Professor M was raised alone. Her mother, a general practitioner, had to work extremely hard to manage her work and the childcare, and Professor M would remain the only child of a lone mother. Well, that must have changed both your thinking and the experience of being in the room with her, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting that there was such an absence of information about this woman. Perhaps relevant to say she was a scientist. She was an academic scientist. And yet I felt that I had really no sense at all about the sort of facts of her life, and that this was a very important event to know about. And once I did, I could begin to understand much more about how great really the sort of deficit had been for her. She was able then to tell me about how she'd really never been allowed to be in any kind of contact with him. She had really had very little knowledge of him. And she knew that he'd remarried a little bit later, but she didn't hear from him after he left. I mean, it was very painful to hear about really such an abandonment. And I wrote about how you might perhaps think that I really missed a lot out in the first 2 years with that patient. You know, how was it that I only knew this so late on into the work? But I wrote and I thought about the fact that her defensive structures were really so firm, so intact. She was so intellectual. She was so rigid that it was really impossible for me to kind of break them down in any kind of way. And but I could see that you know, it was at this point that the description is important, the fetal position. I also talked about how her appearance changed quite radically, and she went from being this rather smart, sort of mature professional looking woman to looking like a very sort of bedraggled little child. So there were these interesting kind of clues, I suppose, which were very nonverbal. But I was also very concerned that some sort of collapse was looming, because this protective belief system that she had really kind of masked so much for so long. Even within this long, I felt, a kind of long, pretty loving relationship that she'd had with her partner, which is so interesting, the capacity of the unconscious to kind of catch up with us, and that it really had caught up with her, provoked by, as it were, this second departure of this very important person in her life.
You mention your perhaps self-consciousness at how your work might be viewed, given that you sat with her for 2 years and let her do what she needed to do. I understand what you mean, but I think we also understand that patients are invited to do with us as they need to do with us. That's our offering to them. You come here and be you, and we will add to that in any way we think could be helpful. And she quite clearly needed to be the her she was, which was walled off, enmeshed in a sort of an abstracted excitement, if you will, in this newfound love that closed off any access to what was painful inside her. And I imagine, I can't know this, but I imagine that had you not sat with her and witnessed with her what she had gone through, she would not have been able to do this next piece of her work, which is to open her painful vulnerability with you. And I think you did just what she needed to do. And the evidence for that is how well things turned out. Let me read a piece that you wrote in your reflections on it. You wrote, "It was a going back in time. A psychical regression had taken place. Her lover, unbeknownst to him, was put in the role of the missing father. This was a completely unconscious displacement by Professor M. I might even propose that she was in the throes of a psychotic disavowal. What that means is that she could go back to a time when she was happily in love with and loved by her father. If she was successful in this disavowal and denial of reality, she didn't have to suffer from his missing, his abandonment, his departure, because there he was, embodied in her lover and her adult self." Yeah, I think that says it very well. And I think, you know, we talk about, and I began our conversation with what it means to share our work with non-clinical readers. What comes across to me is what a privilege it is for you to have participated in both her difficult, flattened time of excitement, and to have sat with her and helped her develop the meaning that had long been hidden, and to have it elaborate in a way that so benefited her. So what we can communicate is how lucky we are to be doing this work, how difficult at times this work is, and how profound this work is. Why don't you read the end of this case, and then we will talk about how you proceeded in terms of other cases.
In the end, she and I came to think that her lover had probably done her a service. The abandoned, demanding little girl, unable to contemplate reality or her parents' complex reasons for separating, had been brought back to life by this man. In effect, she'd remained stuck in a time warp of idealized adulation with her father. She had never moved on and never been angry with him consciously for his departure. Yet she was intuitive enough as a small child to know that to challenge her mother would have been unwise. In time, she could also contemplate her mother's vulnerability, moving to empathy for a young, deserted female GP in the 1960s. She eventually had some admiration for her.
Why don't we pause at that point? Because it really, it gives a flavor for how she was able to consolidate in a more adult way of thinking, with disappointments, okay, anger, but also satisfactions as well. Mm-hmm. It was, from my understanding, it was Professor M's encouragement when she appreciated how essential this kind of therapy is for people who are caught up in many things, in particular affairs, that she suggested to you that you learn more about it and write more about it in a way that can reach the non-clinical public. Why don't you tell us the story? Because it's a whole saga unto itself, how you managed to find people to speak with, the nature of the conversations, interactions, and length of time that you spoke with them, what that gave you access to, what it deprived you of access because they were not your patients. Why don't you give us a small walkthrough?
Yeah, saga is a good word. It was a journey for sure. Well, I had the idea of the book, and I felt that, as we've been discussing, I needed to write about a patient in a sense to show my working. And as you described, Professor M and her, I would say, very sort of informed permission to do that. She had read somewhere, I'm a trustee on a museum, and she'd seen a biography there and seen that I was at work on a second book about affairs. But I realized that it was a very problematic subject to write about. And I think we're going to come on to this, but my solution to writing about existing patients or past patients was to put an advert in various publications, newspapers, magazines, from the London Review of Books, the New York Review of Books, to the Spectator magazine, to Mumsnet, which is a huge online website here for parents in the UK. And I was very skeptical about doing it. It was a friend that suggested it, a journalist friend. But I put an advert in, which maybe I should maybe just read the advert just so that
sure, yeah,
your listeners hear what I said. It said, "Have you had an affair? Published author and psychotherapist keen to interview under strict anonymity for case studies in this underexplored aspect of behavior. Contact researchingtheaffair@gmail.com. And I didn't actually look at this new inbox for a few days, which I think said something about my skepticism as to whether this would work. But then when I did look, I was kind of amazed, and my inbox just kind of continued to fill up with responses from people, potential subjects who wrote all sorts of different, I mean, there were so many different ways that people replied, but it made me realize that I had a methodology, not a sort of defined formal academic methodology, but a methodology I was pretty confident would work. And actually I had far more potential stories and accounts than I had space to write about. But that was how the book became a book.
And how did you decide who to select?
Well, that was where it all became really difficult. And I think why it took me 4 years rather than 2 years to write it. I decided I had a kind of triage system of contacting someone, responding. I would then tell them who I was. And it was interesting, I think, how trusting people were, because obviously I said I was a psychotherapist and I would be abiding by, you know, my ethical guidelines of the regulatory bodies I'm a member of. And I would have a conversation with somebody, and I was, I think, trying to work out, did someone have a sort of language that would mean they were able to tell me what they felt and what had happened? And of course, there are a lot of ethical issues that I then realized I was dealing with. You know, I didn't want to involve people that I felt were vulnerable. I didn't want to involve people that I felt were looking for a psychotherapist. I didn't want to involve people that were doing it for, say, possibly vengeful reasons. They were hoping, you know, in some way their affair might be exposed. I was looking for people who were robust and thoughtful and also interesting, because I mean, I think I do say this in the book, you know, just because you've had an affair does not make you interesting. And I wanted people who could bring their account in a way that was that I could sort of latch onto. An interesting thing is that of the five accounts, and this was completely, you know, unpredicted but interesting, all five of them had attempted either successfully or not successfully to have psychotherapy at some point, which I think is, you know, it's curious, it's interesting.
And speaking of which, that's a lovely segue into the first couple that you've selected for us to discuss. I had my hesitations about our taking on this couple because it involves a woman therapist and a male patient having an affair. And obviously, so you're not only dealing with a transgression in their respective marriages, but you're dealing with a professional transgression. And I thought that might make our unpacking this more difficult, but it contains so much that is so human, so alive, and so difficult that I thought it's worthwhile giving it a go. So with that, Juliet, you want to introduce us to Eleanor and Miller?
Yeah, so Eleanor was a licensed psychotherapist. She is American, and Miller is a lawyer and was her patient. And they met during treatment. A little bit of background perhaps about Eleanor. She was married with pretty young children, and she worked with her husband in a practice that they had created together. And the relationship was very complicated, somewhat abusive by the time she met Miller. But I think it's such an interesting story because I think that I was hesitant about writing it in some ways because I thought, well, is this interesting to me because I'm a psychotherapist? Is it going to be interesting to someone who's never had psychotherapy and may never go anywhere near a psychotherapist's consulting room? But I actually think, and as it developed and I spoke to her over the years, I thought it was really important to write about it because what I think, you know, was a catastrophic boundary violation. And there is obviously some very interesting analytic literature about that, which I refer to. I think is also, as you say, about someone who was, you know, very damaged herself. I think the question I tried to address about what she had found as a solution for herself, which was, I think, to be a psychotherapist, was a way of trying to heal an extremely difficult relationship with her extremely difficult mother. But perhaps given the audience, you know, I know a lot of clinicians that we're talking to today, that it is interesting to think about, I suppose, our own vulnerability to our patients and particularly the kind of critical nature of supervision. Because this was what really the failing was about, was that my sort of contention is that Eleanor knew that she was very attracted to this man. And as clinicians, that there is no rule against that happening. There's no, that can happen. What there is a rule about is about any kind of relationship developing that is not the appropriate therapeutic one in the consulting room. And I think this account of Eleanor is partly about the importance, the essential nature of the couple for psychotherapists, and by that I mean our supervisory couple that is also there to protect us and to understand our own vulnerabilities. You know, the idea that just because we're psychotherapists, we're at less risk of finding someone opposite us attractive is nonsense. And I was very struck by her braveness, actually, her courage in contacting me. She was, to begin with, I think, very anxious about how I would feel about what had happened. And I thought she showed courage in wanting to pursue continuing a conversation with me over several years to tell me, you know, just exactly what the consequences were of this relationship, which were extremely serious. I mean, she lost her career. She lost her livelihood. She was publicly really shamed. The interesting aspect of it is that she continually said to me that this was the first really good, loving relationship that she had ever had. And it continues to be, by the way. They are still together. They seem to be an extremely loving, happy couple, but at such a great cost. And so I think it's an important sort of story for all, you know, for psychotherapists, really. But I think it's also about the protection of the public. I think that, you know, the safety of the patient has to come ahead of everything. And that's why supervision is so important. And I think non-clinical readers have, and this has been the feedback I've had, is they're quite surprised. They don't, you know, and why would you? You wouldn't necessarily know there's this thing called supervision that we all do and mm-hmm. we're all regulated by. But I felt it was important to write about it. And yeah,
well, it's interesting. There are certain details of it that are relevant. Number one, he asked her out for a drink during their third psychotherapy session. That's a piece of information. It's not like they were into 4 years of an analysis and they both decided to act out. This was just when they met. And as you point out repeatedly, she did not pursue supervision, though she had a friend who she would talk to about cases. And the friend had a red flag when she discussed it with her. She said, there's something not right here. But it goes back to the statement I read early on when you said fantasy, people who are in fantasy or in affairs are driven by fantasy. And when I read that more than once, I thought, well, sure, but all intimate relationships are imbued with fantasy. I mean, there's no getting around it, and it's sort of fun, and it needs to be. So the question is, what is it about affairs that warrants it being characterized as fantasy? Now, there is the destructive aspect for her life, for her two families, her children, her career, for sure. And that would be part of the story were it to be unearthed in a depth therapy. But I am taken by not only Eleanor and Miller, but also there are other cases that you write about where I don't want to sound silly when say it, they live happily ever after, but they live happily. That they say that this is a true love that they have found. And you didn't ask them this in particular, but I think the answer would be clear if you ask them, would you go through it again to get here? I think the ones who ended up together would say, certainly. And that's an important piece of information that we have to honor. And for me, that just leaves the certainty of the transgression of the professional boundary is clear. But that is something one should not do. The quote, the transgression from the boundary of marriage for the two of them, if it ends better, and in fact, it ended up, as I understand it, even reasonable with the families that were left, I'm hard-pressed to put a good or bad sign on that. What do you think?
But I agree with you. And I think just as we probably in psychoanalysis don't really think in terms of good or bad, you know, reality is far more nuanced and people mm-hmm. are much grayer, including, as you say, fantasy, I would say, being an important part of all relationships. And there's sure. There's no sort of rule against it. One could even say it's sometimes very, you know, very healthy. That the affair is distinct when fantasy is the key driver and alongside splitting. So when the fantasy, you know, is a real person which means that you break the compact, the agreement that you have with the person that you have the commitment to. And so when I think when those two things are happening in combination and someone is susceptible to an affair, that of course is a very dangerous combination for an existing relationship. And this book is not about good or bad. This book is about what is an affair. Mm-hmm. It's about how does psychoanalysis think about affairs. And it also, I think, I'm sort of the opposite of an apologist for affairs. I think largely they cause a lot of damage and destruction. But there's not a rule book, is there, for how people leave relationships. And I also think that, you know, although psychology gives us plenty of statistics on affairs and one's propensity to be unfaithful and this sort of thing, actually, what I'm interested in as an analyst and as a writer is someone's individual story. And you're right that Eleanor and Miller, I think, would have gone through all that they went through again to be together. And that's not good or bad. It's just, it's a fact. That's what they feel that they are meant right. to be mm-hmm. together. I think there is an argument, which is that sometimes there is something healthy about the choice of an affair. And if you read Eleanor's account, my account of Eleanor's account, I think she was in a very depriving, somewhat abusive marriage that it was very difficult for her to get out of. And she at some unconscious level, this was the only solution. I think there are affairs where it is the only way for somebody to say to their partner, you know, this marriage, this partnership is over. It's the only way out. And so I don't want to generalize about affairs, but I think all of these stories are they're as individual as our patients are and as our relationships are with our patients, but they are a very common behavior. And they are also, you know, characterized by secrecy and dishonesty, which psychoanalysis, it's a sort of key element, isn't it, of making it one's business to hear secrecy and dishonesty from a patient. That is what characterizes, it is necessary at the beginning, at least, for an affair. And I think this is really about how people's unconscious needs often, you know, catch up with them and end up exploding in sometimes very, very dramatic ways by believing that, you know, another person can come into their lives and will solve all the pre-existing problems that predate the relationship.
And then there are affairs, as we're about to discuss, that have a clear underlying precipitant, and that is, painful loss. And this is the affair with Siobhan and Nick. Why don't you tell us about that affair, how it began, and what was discovered?
Siobhan was a woman in her mid-50s who was a mother of four children, and really in one of those marriages where, although she and her husband had met as equals, shall we say, they were both, you know, professionals working in financial services. Her husband's career had sort of taken off, and she had become the stay-at-home parent, and very much the stay-at-home parent. And the marriage had been rather a distant marriage in every way, geographically, but also psychologically. And she ended up with her children grown up in adolescence, being offered a job, so kind of back in the workplace, and she fell in love with her manager. She was the chief marketing officer, he was the chief executive. And what began, I think, as a probably, as she you described it in the opening, as really the first time she had felt seen and really appreciated and understood, went disastrously wrong when her lover decided to stay with his wife rather than to leave her, as Siobhan had thought. There's a theme here. We're talking about two of the relationships where women were disappointed, but for very different reasons. And I suppose without without telling the story, because I think it's probably worth reading, reading it in its entirety. But really, do you agree that? But the really,
yeah.
If I think about the sort of process that I was struck by and wanted to write about, was that this was an occasion where the affair was a substitute for mourning, for grief actually as well, but also mourning, a tremendous loss, a really shocking bereavement that had predated the affair by a number of years and which had never been worked through. And I think this is, the point that I was making earlier, that there's this idea that a third, sort of introducing a third, will in some way help us to solve something that is very, very painful and dormant. And I think the irony, perhaps, or the paradox, better word, for both Professor M and Siobhan, is that they both might say now, and in fact, Siobhan has said to me, that the way that her affair ended and what it kind of propelled her into, which was a sort of collapse, a very physical collapse of sorts, but that actually it forced her to confront this terrible, terrible bereavement. She felt it forced her to end her marriage, and it also forced her, using inverted commas, to an analyst. And this analyst was able to help her work through the loss that, paradoxically, that working through had begun with the lover before he decided that he didn't want to leave his marriage. So
let me read what you wrote about just that point. You write, "Siobhan's relationship with Nick," that's her lover, "delayed her work of mourning. The affair delayed the moment when the grief for Minna, her daughter, could be faced. Freud talks about substitutes, and Nick, I believe, was a substitute for Minna. He was also a substitute for the love that Siobhan was denied in childhood. The physical breakdown and illnesses she experiences are quite common in the bereaved. When the affair ended, finally she could mourn her daughter's death. She was able to accept that her daughter, like Nick, was gone, and that only her memory remained. This does not, as she told me, mean the love has gone. If you have loved someone, you know that the love does not ever leave." Which is a profound evolution from an intolerable loss, which I think anyone could imagine as intolerable. And the best she was able to do at the time, it sounds, was to sort of seal it over. But when the opportunity for excitement and impassioned love came, it sort of picked up that latent sorrow and, quote, solved it, only to then help her get acquainted with it yet anew, what that loss was like. There's another example you give, which is outside the ordinary, which you added at the end, and that is the situation with Rhea and Paul. And one of the differences you note about Rhea versus all the other people you've write about is that she describes, and you accept at face value, that her sense was that she had a happy childhood. With that, tell us about her situation.
Yeah, that's right. I thought it was very important to include this account. This is someone who had a 12-year affair with somebody who was married and continued, actually, to live with his wife. And I think what was striking about her was that she had, during this 12-year period, gone from being in her early 30s to her mid-40s. And things that she had wanted, for example, a big career, let's call it that, she'd undertaken. She'd done a lot of traveling and, worked very hard. As she had also had a baby, not by Paul, but using sperm donation. And I was very struck by this relationship and also by sort of clarity. You're right, I did take it at face value. And, she was not a patient. She was somebody that sort of appeared towards the end of the book wanting to talk to me about it. But she was very clear that sometimes the timing was just wrong for two people. that's how she saw it. She felt that the timing was wrong, that sometimes people do fall in love with people, and that this was the man for her. And she seemed, what struck me was the way that she seemed to live pretty calmly in the hope that one day they would be together. And I was also struck by the kind of reality of how she saw him, which was earlier about idealization, but she was very alive, I think, to how many deficits this man had. And it included that her friends all thought that this was, you know, terrible, that this great woman, as they saw her, was involved with this man who couldn't give her what she, you know, what you should want, you know, a man that will be your partner and be the father of your child. And that was not the way that she saw it. And I thought it was important to include that, because I think also we are living in a time where we're choosing very different ways of being in relationships. In this country, we are marrying less. Even, you know, civil partnership is going down. We're finding different ways of being in couples. Like Rhea, we're having babies, not in the conventional manner. And I think I'm very interested in how psychoanalysis views this, and that the kind of danger, I suppose, of a sort of superego-ish way of thinking about the best thing for someone is to be in a lifelong relationship or marriage. I'm interchanging the two, by the way, but a lifelong partnership, because that is not possible for a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. And the facts are interesting, because actually 61% of us do still, as adults, we choose to live in couples, but in different ways. And I think it will be important that psychoanalysis also you know, develops more of a literature about the ways in which we think about people making very different decisions, you know, not only about sexuality, but also about what kind of couple one wants to be in.
Only because of time limitations, I need to segue us to the topic of outreach, if you will. You wrote me an email as we were discussing this, and you wrote to me, "Something I've been thinking about a lot is how when therapists want to write for non-clinical audiences rather than their peers or profession, you see some very interesting phenomena. Outside our profession, Freud is really still a very unsettling figure, and it's easy to forget that. I would love to talk about how infantile sexuality, or indeed the idea that parents have any kind of impact on our adult selves, can really provoke strongly negative reactions. The response to my book have been pretty positive and certainly very interesting, but I've noticed a bit of, quote, not another therapist telling me my parents are at fault. Why can't they tell me something different? You write, how have we as psychoanalysts failed to communicate in an ordinary way about Freud's ideas and what he can do about it? What we can do about it. This is really my interest as an analyst writing for general audiences, and I'd be very keen to talk about it. I should mention, you use the word keen in your advert as well. I say advert, I'm speaking like I'm from Britain. Keen isn't a word we in the States use, but I love the word. So you're keen to talk about it, so let's.
I think that, you know, in this country, my other interest, as you know, is really in the provision of psychotherapy. And this and in the UK, the reality is that psychoanalysis is not offered by the National Health Service. Mm-hmm. It's barely possible to get psychotherapy in any long-term enduring way in this country that you don't pay for, despite many institutions offering, you know, low fee and free work, often when they're training candidates. But I think it's very important that in the IPA and amongst psychoanalysis, there is space for people to be able to write about psychoanalysis or talk about psychoanalysis in different kinds of languages, and accepting that the sorts of, you know, brilliant writing that you see in the journals is not accessible to people who do not have a clinical training or background, and that there has been and that there is such an interest in what goes on in the consulting room. Let's not mind too much about whether we're talking about psychotherapists or psychoanalysts here, because again, sure, to a sort of general readership, that's why should they understand these distinctions that kind of mm-hmm. become more important than the actual work that is being mm-hmm. done? And I think a book is a way that someone can, you know, find out what on earth it is we do, as you began so eloquently at the beginning, talking about what is this strange relationship that goes on between two people with its asociality. And I think that there's a great curiosity. There's great curiosity in memoir. And there's a great curiosity in nonfiction now. And I think that's because people want to know, what is it, you know, what does it feel like? Tell me, explain to me, what does it feel like to be you and to have made the conscious and unconscious choices that you've made in your life? And that's and I want to write in ordinary words and language about what it is that we do. And I mean, a reader will judge whether I've been successful in doing that or not, but I think that is part of the outreach, and there should be space for people who want to write about psychoanalysis using the ordinary language we use with our patients in the consulting room.
The name of the book is Affairs, True Stories of Love, Lies, Hope, and Desire. And when you were describing the work, and my sense was what non-clinical people can pick up your work and others, is how profound it is. We devote big swaths of our lives to learning how to do this as best we can. But Julia, this is not your and my first conversation. You and I had an interview some years ago on a different podcast about your first book, which was a memoir, and it's titled The State of Disbelief, A Story of Death, Love, and Forgetting. And in thinking about that as we're speaking today and enjoying reading your book and meeting you again, I think what we may sort of understandably undersell or underpresent to the community is how much love is a part of what we do. Now, obviously, that is a loaded topic. People spend years in a therapist and analyst office unpacking what that means, for sure, and it's worthy of unpacking. But, and yes, there is the famous quote of Freud that it is a cure through love. But, I mean, the dedication that, speaking of you now, I know it's not limited to you, but you are a wonderful exemplar of it. The love that you bring to the work, the carefulness of it, the boundaried appreciation of that love is, I think, really what people will take away from your work. It's, yes, it's the content, but your personhood, your immersion into caring for how these people do in their lives, and you're devoting yourself to doing the best you can so they can do well, I find very communicable. And I imagine many of our listeners will as well. So all that said, I want to thank you. I look forward to your next book that we will have a conversation about. And Julia, it has again been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you, Harvey, so much. And thank you again for the podcast. It's just great. And I learn something new every week, which is probably the sort of part of the joy of this work, isn't it? Is the ongoing learning and elaboration of our own development. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.